Good morning.
Morning.
Can everyone hear me okay? Good. Good. Well, it's good to be here. I'm going to talk this morning about loving kindness. And I'm going to start with two quotes. The first one is a very short quote from the Dalai Lama. My religion is kindness. And the second one is from Sharon Salzberg, who wrote this book, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. And this one is on your program, I believe. She said, spiritual practice, by uprooting our personal mythologies of isolation, uncovers the radiant, joyful heart within each of us and manifests this radiance to the world. I just thought that was a nice place to start. And sometimes I see people out in the world, and very often Buddhist practitioners who have this smile that just has that radiance. And I truly believe this line when I look at certain smiles that I see around here and some other places as well. This practice may very well begin for us as us wanting something, wanting to improve, wanting to be calm, wanting to be happy, wanting something for ourselves. But the more we do this practice, the more we see it's about being kind to others, being compassionate, going out into the world and serving others. In Mahayana Buddhism, we have the ideal of the Bodhisattva, which is a helping being, a being which goes out there and helps. And that's really all there is to do. So loving kindness, also known as metta, this is something that Ben Connolly talked about just a few weeks ago, and I'm sure some of you were here for that. And he talked about this practice. In Buddhism, loving kindness is not just an idea of something really nice. It's actually a specific set of practices that we do. And it's a way of using practice, as Ben said, to transform our habits or karma. This is a little different from shikantaza, just sitting. We talk a lot about just sitting, no goal, no reason to do zazen. It's just being. It's just being there, opening up, seeing what is present, no agenda whatsoever. And that's kind of our essential practice. But still, there are these other practices where we try to do something. We try to maybe transform our bad karma, try to open our hearts. And that's what this metta practice is. And there's a basic practice which you could find in this book, Loving Kindness, or in many other places, I'm sure, on the internet you could find this. You can start with yourself. You start sort of encouraging compassion for yourself, and you say to yourself, may I be safe and protected? May I be happy and at peace? May I be healthy and strong? May I be at ease? And you can repeat that many times. And then you can say that for a loved one, someone you really love, really care about. May this person be safe and protected. May this person be happy and at peace, healthy and strong, at ease. And then you do that for someone who's neutral. You have neutral feelings toward. Then you do it towards someone whom you feel ill will. Someone that it's that kind of pushes your buttons. You know, this is kind of hard for you to do, but you do it anyway. And then you do all four equally, all four of these beings equally, and then you do it for all beings. So, today is Father's Day, which I'm happy about because I'm a father. And I'm going to tell a story about my father today. And I've been thinking about doing this talk. It's been kind of percolating for maybe about 2 years now. I've been thinking about this talk a lot. And I keep thinking, no, I shouldn't do that one. That's not really a Dharma talk. But it keeps wanting to come out. And I think it's ready. It's a very personal story, too. I think it's ready, and I think it's going to help me to talk about loving kindness. So I'm going to do it. It's about a turning point for my family. It's kind of a long story. I've got to give you the background. We're going back in time, so just kind of relax. Sit back and relax. I'll tell you a story. So my dad, if he were alive, he would be 88. He was born in 1923. He died actually in 1996, which is about 15 years ago. And he grew up on a farm in northwest Iowa. And he was of that generation where he grew up in the Depression. He was a child during the Depression. And then in high school, he was in high school when World War II broke out. And then he graduated in 42 and went to the Army and was stationed here. And then he went to Germany and got there just about when the fighting ended, so he never saw any action. And he came back and he married my mom, whom he had known since second grade, I think. And they wanted to farm. And he could have gone to college for free on the GI Bill, and he didn't. And later he came to regret that. But at the time, he just wanted to farm. There's something about farming that kind of gets in your blood, I think. So they farmed on this series of rented farms. And then my grandfather, who owned a really nice farm down there, retired and moved into town. And my father took over my grandfather's farm. Now, my grandfather, I have to give you a little description of him. He was a little man, even smaller than me, but he was very wiry and strong and tough, and he was a very good farmer. He was very smart, and out of eight brothers, he somehow was the one who got the farm, who got to continue it, the farm that his father had started. He was politically very conservative, very different from my dad and me. He was a Goldwater supporter. That's pretty conservative, although these days that might be mainstream. Anyway, so this was a nice farm that my dad moved on to. It was kind of prosperous. There was this barn. It was 99 feet long. It was a basement barn, just a beautiful barn. Nice corn crib that we used to climb up in when we were kids. Really big windmill, beautiful windmill. Beautiful farmhouse kind of set into the hill so that when you drive up to it, you go, oh, that's a nice-looking house, you know. There were walnut trees in the yard. There was this little old smokehouse. There were pastures all around with sloughs in them, kind of low, wet places. It was hilly. It was very hilly, and there were a lot of rocks. There were rocks all over the place, so many that we gave them away. We encouraged people to come take them. They took some up to Arnold's Park and built walls up around the amusement park area. But that's another story. So that was the farm my dad took over. And my dad was also a fairly small man. I considered him tall. He was 5'7". And very thin, and very shy. He wore glasses. He was very shy. If he were hanging out with a group of guys at the grain elevator or something, he'd probably be the last one to talk. He just was not somebody who would sort of put himself forward, you know. And he was very tan. His face was burned just really brown by the sun. And till the day he died, he had lines on his arms and at his neck, you know. That's called a farmer tan for good reason. He was very smart. And he studied farming methods. He had a number of books on farming, and he would do things like rotating crops and things like that. And soil conservation was important to him. And one thing that he really cared about as far as soil conservation goes was contour plowing or contour farming, which some of you may be familiar with. I see a couple of heads nodding, and this is actually essential to this story, believe it or not. Stick with me. You'll learn about farming. So contour plowing, say you've got a hill, and there are two ways that you can farm this. You can take your plow and your other equipment, and you can kind of go straight up the hill and just divide your land into rectangular fields, and then you might be going straight up the hill. And when you do this, what you're doing is making channels so that when it rains, the water will just flow straight down the hill, and it will take soil with it. And the soil washes down, and the soil washes into streams, and you get these streams choked with silt. And also farm chemicals come down there, too, so you get pollutants going into the streams. Also, it gets drier up on top of the hill, so you don't have a very good yield up there. And it washes away the topsoil. And maybe you've noticed this when you're driving out in the country. You might see some hills out that are being farmed, they've been plowed, and they're just kind of tan on top. And that's because the topsoil has been washed away. And I've read many times that it takes 500 years to build up 1 inch of topsoil. So say there was 5 inches of topsoil up on top of that hill. That means 2,500 years of plants dying and building up the soil has been reversed in just a few decades. So this is kind of a serious matter because, you know, we want to take care of the earth. We have a lot of people to feed. So we try to avoid this. And contour farming means you follow the shape of the land and you make this horizontal, you plow horizontally across the slope along its elevation lines like this. You follow it. So then when the water comes down, every row it hits is like a little earth dam, right? So the water is not going to come, is not going to go straight down. It's going to kind of stay up there. And erosion is going to be greatly reduced. And so you have less pollution and you have a lot of good effects that way. And it's also, these contours, they're really beautiful. If you ever go out and you see these, you drive by them and they follow the shape of the hill. And they're just beautiful. You see a lot of these over in Wisconsin because it's very hilly over there. Sometimes people take it a step further and they'll have strips of different crops in these contours. So that's even prettier. You have these undulating stripes across the land. Where it's really hilly, they might build terraces. You see a lot of these in western Iowa. So you'll have a terrace built up. It's kind of like a step. And you've got a little grassy area that the pheasants and other things can enjoy. They may leave grassy waterways going down the slope. So if you can indulge me a little bit, I get off on these things, you know. If you can indulge me a little bit. So this, I mean, this is so cool. It's kind of a symbol of just sort of leaving the earth as it is and working with the earth, you know, and kind of having a loving relationship with the earth versus domination of the earth, you know. We're preserving it. We're letting it be what it is. We're letting that soil stay and we're letting the crops grow. It's still prairie, you know. It's crops now, but it's still prairie. And I think there's an element here of respect for the mystery in the way we treat the earth. You know, we can't really know which parts of the earth, the life upon it, might be beneficial for us, might be beneficial for the earth itself. There are all these species, and some get wiped out, and we don't know which ones, you know, might ultimately provide us some cure for some horrible disease or something, you know, because we find these things, we find drugs by checking out these various rare plants in the Amazon or something like that. We don't know which ones are important. So if we treat them all as sacred, you know, that makes us feel more safe. We treat them all as sacred. I've heard it said in when we do retreats here and we have this ritual way of eating using oryoki bowls, which we wrap up in a neat little set, that you should take care of those oryoki bowls as if they're your own eyes. Give them that much attention, that much attention. And I feel like we should do that with the earth too. You know, respect the contours of the earth. Respect it as it is. Treat it as sacred. If we're building our house on a hill, build into the side of the hill so it fits in. Don't build it on top. Don't try to dominate the hill, you know. So this idea of contour farming was pretty new in the 1950s in Northwest Iowa, apparently. And my dad decided this would be a good thing to do. It had never been done, at least on his farm before. So he called the county extension agent, and they would come out and they would set up your contour lines for you, because I guess it took some education to be able to do this. You still with me on this stuff? Okay. And my grandpa freaked out. He completely freaked out. He said, there aren't going to be any crooked rows on my farm. What are my neighbors going to think if I have crooked rows on my farm? And he said, absolutely no way, it's not going to happen. And there was some kind of big confrontation, and I couldn't get my dad to talk about this stuff. And I got my mom to talk about it a little bit. And I know there was a confrontation, and my dad said that, you know, my grandfather freaked out. My other grandfather, whom I always knew as a model of equanimity, felt the same way. And he called this county extension agent a very, very bad name. And my dad felt that, by extension, he was calling him this very, very bad name, and it hurt. I think it hurt him for the rest of his life. And I don't know what happened. Was there a confrontation out in the field there? I mean, did he actually call this extension agent this bad name to his face? Or was this kind of a slow-burning thing that people didn't really talk about very much? I don't know. But it was so bad that that was it. And my dad and mom decided to move. Not only to move and leave this farm, but to move really far away. And they would give up their secure future. And my mom supported my dad in this all the way. She's like, we're not going to do this. You know, we're not going to put up with this. And they had gone to Fargo, North Dakota once to buy cattle. That seems like a long ways to go to buy cattle, but that's what they said. And they stopped on the way back to see my great-uncle Art. Now, my great-uncle Art had moved to North Dakota some years before and had this little tiny farm up there. And I asked my mom once, why did Uncle Art move to North Dakota of all places? You know, not the first place that leaps into my mind as a place to go. And she said he owed money to people in Iowa and Minnesota. So they stopped there and they liked it up there. This was flat country, very different from Iowa. This is in near Wahpeton in the southeast corner of North Dakota near the Red River. And this is the bed of Glacial Lake Agassiz, which, you know, used to be there. And it's completely flat. We used to stand at the end of our driveway and watch for the school bus in the morning, and we could see it 4 miles away because it was so incredibly flat. And there weren't that many trees either. And they liked it. They liked it. You know, no need for contour lines here. And so they bought this farm. And I can remember my mom, I was 3 years old, I can remember my mom leaning down to us in the kitchen and saying, how would you boys like to move to North Dakota? And we said, yay, because of the way she said it. And we had we had no idea what it was, but we went. It was cool. It was a nice place. It was a beautiful place. 360-acre farm, half a square mile, kind of this vast, empty place. But for us, it was a place of adventure, you know. And my mom would talk about how nice it was to just have our own family there, you know, at Christmas and Thanksgiving. It's just our own family, you know, because all of that stuff was difficult. And we still saw our grandparents. We'd still go down to Iowa a couple times a year, and I never knew there was any tension at all. And I'd go stay with my grandparents for weeks at a time in the summer, which was great. But looking back at my childhood, it seems almost idyllic, you know. And part of this is selective memory, I think. You kind of block out some of the things that weren't so pleasant. And there were problems, there were difficulties. But basically, you know, I had this very stable family, you know, two parents, three brothers, and they were there all the time, you know, and we did things together. And I had these long summer days where I could just go out and have adventures all day and climb trees and play baseball with my brothers and go down to the creek and things like that. And long winter evenings where we would play board games and things like that. And so I had a lot of time, you know, kind of just to be with my family. And I'm really happy about that. And I'm really aware of sort of how lucky I am to have had that. And sometimes I'm a little concerned that this might make it a little hard for me to relate to people whose childhoods were not so easy, you know. And as a Buddhist teacher, when I talk to people about the practice, you know, I talk about how confronting your own demons is kind of an essential part of this practice, you know. And my demons may not be the same as yours. And what if you've had some kind of serious trauma or something, very difficult childhood, how can this practice help you? And I'm always thinking about what can I do with that. In my last talk, when I read Hemingway's Big Two-Hearted River, was kind of about that. I keep circling back to this theme because Nick Adams had been so traumatized during the war, and he was on this camping trip, and he's holding himself together by being very, very mindful, you know. And so I say, if you've had serious trauma, you know, maybe counseling is in order, not just a spiritual approach. But that doesn't mean the spiritual approach cannot be part of this, you know? It needs to be. It needs to be. Whatever's happened in our lives is part of this practice. It has to be. So I keep that in mind. Now back to the story. So it was difficult farming in North Dakota because half a section, half a square mile, 360 acres, was considered a very small farm up there at the time. And a lot of years it's way too dry, much less rainfall up there than down here. Some years it was too wet, and when it's too wet, the water just stands there because it's so flat, there's no place to go. If the crops are good, the prices are probably bad. My dad was in debt up to his neck. You know, I never realized that. I knew we went like twice a year to see the PCA man, and all I knew was that meant I had to wait in the car for like an hour and a half. But those were the people my dad owed money to, and he had borrowed, you know, totally. And I think he had to talk to him about, well, what crops you're going to have this year, you know. So he wasn't entirely free. And we were actually quite poor. We were the poorest family I knew, almost. We didn't have a telephone. We couldn't afford a telephone. We just didn't get a lot of stuff, you know. If when holidays came and we had this idea of what we wanted, we would say what we wanted and we would get something. But it might be kind of a pale imitation of that, you know. I remember one time my mom loved antiques, and she had these pieces, these four old pieces she had had for years. And one summer she had to sell them, and I think it just broke her heart, you know. So that was hard. And if we had stayed in Iowa, we would have prospered on that farm. So my dad really gave up a lot. So basically, he gave up financial security for an environmental principle. Before environmentalism was even a word, people talked about conservation, but there wasn't this awareness about preserving the environment. And he really gave up a lot. And I'm so, you know, proud of him for that. It's not too surprising because he always had this kind of independent streak, and he would do things in his own small way. He helped organize the Farmers Union, which at that time was kind of a leftist organization among farmers. And he said he'd go out to farms and talk to people, and they'd call him a communist and send him away. This was in the 50s, you know. And he turned against the Vietnam War when I was about 15. And when it seemed like virtually everybody else in North Dakota was in favor of it. And if you weren't around then, you just cannot have any idea how divided the country was then, or how much kind of hatred there was around that war, or what it meant to turn against it. If you turned against the war, you were kind of turning against everything, you know, and you were kind of joining the other side. And he was not, you know, any rabble-rouser, but he would let people know how he felt about that. So I'm very proud of him for that. But there's more to the story. There's always more, right? We have this big interrelated reality, and we look at it, and we pick out certain things, and we construct our narrative, because that's the way our minds work, and we stick with the narrative, and we refine it. Pretty soon we think we've figured it out. We have to remind ourselves now and then that that's what we picked out. That's not reality. That's what we picked out. So there's more to this, and that is that my dad and my grandpa really never got along, because my grandpa had a little bit of a mean streak, I'd have to say, and was pretty mean to my dad when he was little. Not that there was any physical abuse that I'm aware of at all, but just kind of making fun of him and maybe humiliating him a little bit in such a way that this hurt him a lot, and I think he carried that with him his whole life. And you know, I don't know why that happened. These things tend to kind of travel down generations, you know. Somebody's father is mean to them, they're mean to their kids. It just keeps going generation after generation. Who knows, that may be what happened with my grandpa, you know. He wasn't that far removed from pioneers who had a very hard life out there farming, and they had this idea sometimes they had to toughen up their kids. And it's strange to talk about my grandfather in this way. I really loved my grandfather, you know, and he was always very nice to me. it's strange to talk about him in this way, but and I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was going to help me teach. Because that toughness, that meanness, isn't the whole story either. I remember how he used to teach me how to do things. One time, when I was real little, I was maybe six, I came down there to stay with him, and we went out to a granary, and he was working there to repair it, you know. I don't know what he was doing, replacing boards or something. And he pointed to a place where there were about 40 or 50 nails sticking up that had been pounded in part way. And he says, "Will you help me out? Will you pound those nails?" So I did, and bent over most of them, you know, because pounding nails is a bit of a skill. And I realized, actually, when I was preparing this talk, well, maybe sooner than that, doesn't matter. But, of course, he put those in there just so he could teach me how to pound nails, right? He didn't actually need the help of pounding down all those nails. So he would do those kinds of things. But my dad was a little damaged. But here's the thing. My dad was always really kind to me and my brothers. He was really nice. He never did that kind of stuff to us. He never tried to humiliate us, make fun of us. He encouraged us. He was, you know, at worst a little distant sometimes, a little preoccupied sometimes. He had all of these difficulties going on. But he never continued that type of behavior toward us. He never, as far as I know, struck anyone in anger in his whole life. So it stopped with him, you know. And that's why he's heroic to me. I'm proud about the soil conservation thing, but he's heroic to me because that ended with him. But the sad thing about it is that he didn't really know what to do with that pain. You know, he didn't have a spiritual life. We went to church. They stopped going to church when I was about 3 years old. It just, you know, didn't have meaning for my dad. He was an atheist. And guys of his generation didn't really talk about that kind of thing. You know, they just kept it inside. And he kept it inside, and he had physical problems. He had, like, digestive things going on his whole life that were really bad. And he had a tendency to be anxious and to worry a lot. You know, he had the debt. He had the difficulty of farming. He was looking after four boys, you know, the rest of his family, his extended family. It was hard, and it was almost overwhelming, I think, sometimes. So it's in this kind of painful place, when I think of how hard it was for my dad, that I'd like to come back to loving kindness. And I was looking through Sharon Salzberg's book here, and thinking about my dad and looking at these chapter titles and thinking, you know, what is there here that fits him? And I look at forgiveness, and I think forgiveness. But that's what could have helped my dad, needing to forgive his own father and himself too. Because I think we humans have this really strange tendency that when we're mistreated or something, part of us feels we deserved it somehow. You know, people do that. And so you need to really extend the forgiveness. So the question is, what is it that we want for the people that we love the most who are really suffering? What is it we want for them? You know, do we want them to be successful? Do we want them to make a lot of money? Do we want them to have a lot of fun? No. You know what we want for them? We want them to be able to let go of their pain, right? That's what we want for them. People we love who are suffering. We want them to be able to let go of the pain. We just want to tell them it's okay. You know, it's all right. It's over now. You can let it go. If people have hurt you, that's over and it's okay. You know, please do that for me. And a couple of aspects of forgiveness from Sharon Salzberg here. We often think of our aversion to others, she says, as hurting them, but it's more likely to hurt us. That's an important thing to remember about forgiveness. When we are held prisoner by our own past actions or the actions of others, our present life cannot be fully lived. The resentment closes our heart and prevents us from living. That's why we forgive. I mean, it may help the other person, it may not, but it is definitely going to help us if we forgive. It's important to remember what forgiveness is not. It's not about forgetting ourselves in total deference to others. It does not mean condoning a harmful action or denying injustice. It should never be confused with being passive in the face of violation or abuse. So you forgive the person who has hurt you without in any way saying, it's okay that you did that. It's still completely wrong that you did that. So what forgiveness is? Forgiveness is the inner relinquishment of guilt or resentment. As it grows within us, it may take an outward form. We may seek to make amends. We may just leave it behind us. We may demand justice. We may resolve to be treated better. And we can work on forgiveness even if we don't feel like we're ready. In practicing metta, we don't have to make a certain feeling happen because we may think, well, I'm just not ready to forgive. I'm not ready to go there. I can't do that. But as we do this practice and we repeat, you know, may this person toward whom I feel ill will, who has hurt me, be safe and protected, we may feel forgiveness at that moment. We may feel nothing at all. We may feel something like aversion or hatred. That's okay. We are planting seeds by forming a powerful intention in our mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. So you don't have to be ready to forgive. You just have to be ready to forgive. So we settle back and we plant the seeds of intention. And that's not so hard. And during the last retreat, I thought, I have a little forgiveness to do myself. And during the retreat, I just kind of opened myself up, this recent one we had. And I found forgiveness towards someone coming over me, totally unexpected. It just kind of happened. These things happen in time. So that's what I would say to my dad. If I were omniscient and I could go back in time and he'd let me talk to him about this kind of stuff, which he probably wouldn't, but if he would, I'd say, you know, I want you to let go of the hurt. I want you to let go of the hurt and be free. That's the best thing you can ever do for me. You've done a lot. But could you do this one? This one more thing. And there are actually techniques for doing this. And I think maybe, you know, thinking about my dad and what I would want for him helps me a little bit with my problem about what to say to folks who have had that kind of difficult childhood. Because here's what I would say to such a person. You know what you want for the people you love the most. You just want them to find a way, any way under the sun to let go of this pain. And what you have to do is turn this around. Turn this around toward yourself. What you want the hurt people to do, the ones you love the most, you must do that yourself. That's what people would want for you to be. That's what they would want for you. And sometimes I think that it actually can help people, even people in the past. And I know this is a little far-fetched. This sounds a little bit like magic. But if everything is interrelated, well, we really don't know, really, do we? I mean, maybe we can really help all beings throughout space and time right now. Maybe by doing this practice well, I can really do that. I don't know. That's the mystery again. We don't really know. We can treat this as sacred and we can see what happens. Maybe I can't help all beings throughout space and time. But I know if in this moment I make a choice to either be present and really come back to what's here instead of trying to distract myself, I know that's going to help somebody somewhere. That's going to change me. That's going to make me more kind. That's going to make me more open. And lately I've been thinking about that. And it's been this great motivation for practice, you know. This moment, I could give up right now, or I can come back and I can really be here with this task I'm doing I can wash this dish. And that is going to affect other beings, this tiny little task. That's been very helpful for my practice lately. So there are ways to do this. You can think of a person who has unequivocal love for you, you know, maybe a grandparent or maybe a parent or maybe a friend, and just kind of bring them into your mind and just kind of feel that love they have for you and kind of honor them by accepting that love. Or maybe you can think of someone toward whom you have unequivocal, complete love, maybe your child or something like that, and send that love out and then let some of it come back to you. You're doing it for that person. There's no separation. And there's a forgiveness meditation in this book, which it's a couple pages long. It tells you how to do it. Sit comfortably, close your eyes, and it is in three parts. If I have harmed anyone unknowingly, I ask forgiveness. Offer forgiveness to those who have harmed you. And what is the third part? In the end, we turn our attention to forgiveness of ourselves. If there are ways you have harmed yourself, or not loved yourself, or not lived up to your own expectations, this is the time to let go of unkindness toward yourself because of what you have done. And in this moment of letting go, what is that, this moment of letting go? There aren't really instructions for this. I can't say, here's how you let go. But I can give you some advice on that, which is, don't look for the answer of how can I let go. Hold the question, how can I let go? Hold that question. That brings you to this place of openness. How can I let go? What is this thing? What is this thing I'm feeling? How can I let go of that? And I'm sure if you hold that question rather than looking for an answer, that is going to be more effective. And I know you can do it. I know you can do it. Think of the Buddha's love for all creatures. I know you can do this. So, back to the story. So what happened with my dad? This is kind of the denouement here. We farmed in North Dakota for about 11 years and gave it up because we weren't making any money. Just couldn't make it. And moved into town, moved to Wahpeton. Sold half the farm. And suddenly we had money. And we got this nice little kind of ranch-type house in Wahpeton. And we bought a new stereo, I remember. And that was kind of nice. My dad got some training to be a machinist. Couldn't really get a job as a machinist. Worked in a factory. Didn't really like it. Moved back to Iowa. My grandpa had come out of retirement and farmed. He was farming the old farm again. About the time we got back to Iowa, he sold the farm to one of my high school classmates. So I think my dad at that point had no interest in farming again. So my dad got a job in a factory down there, and I didn't really like it. My dad and my grandpa seemed to get along better. My grandpa was getting old. My mom and dad took care of him some. And I think there was some reconciliation there. I think that got better. Contour plowing did catch on, but not everywhere. And I think actually it's being used less and less because farms are getting bigger and equipment is getting bigger, and it's not as easy to do it with the big equipment. And I went back to North Dakota for my 30th reunion, and I revisited our old farm. Hadn't been there in years. And I did say it was completely flat there, but actually that's not true. There was this area called a coulee, which was just kind of a low depression, usually dry, but when it rained really hard, the water would run down through there. And I went to take a look at that, and my dad had used these really nice contours along the edge of that because there were slight hills there and had left a grassy waterway about as wide as this room, maybe 20 or 30 feet wide. And the people who own the farm now farm a lot of land, and that quarter section. Quarter square mile is just one big field, and they farm straight down into that coulee and out again, you know. And the soil's just, I'm sure it's just running out of there when it rains really hard, and that makes me sad. That hurts. So my dad worked in another factory, didn't really like it, but then he did a strange and surprising thing when he was in his early 50s. He started partying. He had never partied. I had never seen him take a drink hardly in his life. But he started having a good time. And he and my mom would go out and they would hear rock and roll bands and stuff. They're in their early 50s. And they started having all of these young friends. And they knew everybody in all the bands. And they would go to these parties. They would go to these like long afternoon parties by the lake where everybody's hanging out and having a good time. My dad grew his hair a little bit long and back. This is a World War II guy. Nobody did this. And he was like kind of a local celebrity. And he never liked his name. His name was Francis. And he hated that name. And he changed his name to Frank. And everybody knew him as Frank. And I felt like a little bit of a celebrity when I'd come home because I was Frank's son. And he loved that 70s kind of country rock, like Ozark Mountain Daredevils and Kris Kristofferson, Jerry Jeff Walker, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, of course. And I still have those records. My brother and I divided them up, so I have half of them. Sometimes I will put one on and I'll listen to it. I'll listen to that 70s country rock because it's all about just sort of being laid back and having a good time and feeling good. And I put those on and I feel really happy because you know what? My dad had a few good years there. He had a great time. And I could say, well, you know, you're not supposed to party. You're supposed to face your problems and have a rigorous spiritual practice. And that's what I should be telling everybody here. But forget that, you know. He had a really nice time, and that makes me happy. And who knows? You know, maybe somewhere in that process he found what he was looking for. You know, maybe he was able to let go of that pain, at least for a while. And I'm really happy about that. So, and then he got a little older, and things got, you know, kind of difficult again, and that scene kind of disappeared for one reason or another. But I like to remember him during his country rock years when he was happy. Or I like to remember him when I was really little and he was farming in North Dakota and he loved to farm. And he would show me how to do things. You know, he would teach me things. So, loving kindness, that's it. I remember him at his best, at his kindness, at his kindest. And when I remember him, I resolve to be happy. I resolve for all beings to be happy. And I think that's about the best I can do on Father's Day. So that's what I've got this morning. Thank you for your patience. Thanks for indulging me in this very personal story. If anyone has any comments, I'd love to hear them. Yes?
You said your dad started partying and having fun. And I was curious, when his father died?
It was after my dad started partying, so there was no connection there. My grandfather lived quite a lot longer yet, and I think my grandpa may have gotten hints that this was going on, and I'm sure he disapproved. Yes?
You said your father was shy, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also would speak out against things that he did not believe in, like the war and stuff like that. And so I think that was tremendously courageous to overcome that, you know, barrier, you know, the shyness to come out and, you know, speak. So I guess your father was very courageous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I would agree. I think that's true. It was hard. Oh, okay. Basically, the comment was that even though my father was very shy, he would speak out against things, and that must have been very hard for him. And so that was a courageous thing to do. And I agree with that, because it was very difficult for him to do that. So, thank you. Yes, Kate.
You know, it's interesting because at some point in your talk, you've talked about, and there's so much going on that I lost it, but about how we are, the stories are the things that we put in the story.
Yes.
And I noticed that the thing that you put in the story about your father and your grandfather is your father as the environmentalist. And I think that that is true, but I don't think that is the whole story. I think that has to do with other things. You know, perhaps the fact that your grandfather had given your father control of the farm, but not completely. And was he ever going to get out from under his... I mean, this is my story I'm making up, but it's interesting because you said, you know, we make the stories that we bring. We make the stories, and that is... the story that you've made, but I suspect that somebody else would make a different story.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I am picking out part of this story,
right,
and it's a true story and useful story, but every true story is only part of the thread, mm-hmm, and in a sense is not true. So there is more going on here.
Yeah.
But we have to pick out a thread, right?
Otherwise,
no talk. Yeah. 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 Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
I have a question.
Yes.
In your practice in general, when you talk about your dad, did you say starting to have fun?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to do that. But I'm serious. And
uh-huh.
Somehow without a lot of
intoxicants. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if you see a lot of, I don't know how to come in this question. I mean, do you see that as maybe part of your spiritual path? Like how
over
yourself and have fun.
Let me try to rephrase this, restate it. How can we hang out with loving kindness? part of practice should be to have fun. Part of loving kindness should be sort of relaxing and having fun. It would be nice to do that. You know, maybe I'm serious all the time. It'd be nice to do that, but without intoxicants. Loosen up and have fun. I would say yeah. Having fun is a pretty important part of this practice. I'm sorry?
You're for it.
I'm for it, yes. I want to go on the record as being in favor of fun, you know, which I think is good because we can look pretty serious around here, right? No, I think it is sort of an act of kindness toward yourself and everyone to kind of loosen up and have fun. Yeah, well, find fun people and see how they do it. I don't know. I don't mean to be flippant. Yeah. Okay. Yes?
I have a comment about that. And I guess the best way that I have fun is to be around children.
Mm-hmm.
And also to learn loving kindness to them, because they are so innately loving kind. You know, when you just see, like, you know, someone gets hurt and they'll just go over and go, oh, are you okay? You know, it's just something that naturally inside of them that gets plucked out of them.
Right.
Through the educational system or, you know, whatever. And it's really a gift to be around children. And it just brings that alive in them that way for us.
Could you hear that comment over there? Okay. Well, it was about the best way to have fun is to hang out with children. And it's a way to learn loving kindness too, because they can be so loving and so kind. Yeah. So, okay. Yes?
I just wondered if you get any tips with a parent or whatever who's holding in, resentment or anger because of some of the things in the past, you have any advice for reaching
How to reach someone, say you have a parent or someone who is holding something in and is resentful, how do you reach them? Yeah, that's tricky and kind of depends on your relationship with them and how much they are willing to open up and talk about that, I think, because people could get really closed around these kind of issues. And they can say, I'm just not going to go there. I'm just not going to talk about it. So it's kind of like they've built up an armor. And I don't know, just look for little ways to open that up, you know, and maybe even think of it as preliminary work. You know, we're way far away from getting to the real thing here, but we can find some opening here, you know, some little opening of the heart, and maybe that will be the way in, and that's about the best I can do. Mm-hmm.